In a world completely overrun by inane media, there are podcasts that rise above the rest. This is not one of those. Two middle-aged white guys from Middle America talk about random shit for about an hour or so. This is the Magical Talking Hatch.
I said tequila, Diet Mountain Dew, and a little bit of lemon juice.
What is in a margarita anyway? For real.
A real margarita would have tequila and triple sec and lime juice.
Triple what?
Triple sec. An orange liqueur of some sort. Oh. And lime juice. So, this is just a more disgusting version.
Mountain Dew, though?
I was tired, and so I needed some caffeine. And I don't have any other mixers in the house. I got that from the vending machine at work.
Well, okay. Is it any good?
No. But that's okay. Welcome, everybody, to episode 70 of the Magical Talking Hat, the only podcast in the world that, in honor of Friday the 13th tomorrow, is going to have secret hidden messages in the episode if you play it backwards.
Oh, you should have told me that ahead of time. You should have told me that ahead of time.
I wasn't prepared. I used to listen to the Great White North album so much that I pretty much had that backward section memorized. Like, backward. Like, I never heard the real thing. But I could, like, do that.
It's bit. Kind of amazing how often we talk about that album.
Because, really, I like to think of it as the first podcast. It's seriously, if you think about how this podcast is, it's kind of like that. By the way, Ezzy's here, pissing me off. She was really riled up earlier, so... I'm Tony.
And I'm William.
And this is episode 70. And...
And I'm glad it's not as hot outside as it was last week.
No, it's not good, though.
No.
But it's not like it was, which, yeah.
Last week was pretty miserable.
Oh, yeah.
And we're doing... Well, never mind.
Yeah, no. No, I don't leave until the week after this week.
Right, right.
So... Next week, we'll have to do two episodes.
So we'll be here a long time.
Yes.
Without the air conditioner on. See, if you're wondering why I'm mentioning this, it's because we record right next to Tony's air conditioner, and we have to shut it off when we record, which usually isn't a big deal. But when it's really hot outside, it can get kind of uncomfortable in here.
It can be bad. Episode 12, the greatest episode ever, was okay, but then we immediately afterwards had to do... the tribute, because we lost the episode.
Was it hot that day? I don't remember.
Well, it was hot in here.
Oh, it was hot in here, okay.
I know by the time we were finished, among other terrible stresses on my life, were the fact that I was really hot at that
point. Well, I just remember last week we recorded an episode, just one, and boy, I mean, it was just an hour, but it seemed like a long time.
Well, and I prep. I go swim right before, so that helps me, which is good, because otherwise I would really be messed up, but...
So, yeah.
Yeah, we're out of the triple digits.
Yep.
And we were in the 80s for a little while, and now we're back in the 90s.
Last week it was, as they say, hotter than Hell's Kitchen on lasagna night.
I don't believe they say that.
Oh. Okay.
Well, but it was, I believe.
How about this one? Hotter than pitchfork sales in Frankenstein Town. How about that one? Do they say that?
No.
Oh.
Nobody says that. Pitchfork sales... in Frankenstein.
Are you sure? People don't say that?
What the hell is Frankenstein Town, is what I want to know.
I don't know.
You, the banner carrier for Mary Shelley, come up with Frankenstein Town.
Are you sure people don't say those things? Because I'm pretty sure I've heard people say that.
Maybe the people that you hang out with.
Yeah, okay.
Not the people I hang out with. So.
You don't. I like the lasagna night one. I think that's pretty good.
I like that you like it. So how was your week, William?
It was uneventful, really. Nothing really happened, I don't think. I can't think of anything.
I feel like mine's been fairly uneventful also. I'm living La Vida Bachelor now. Trish left Tuesday night. And I'm on my own all the rest of this week and through next week. And then at the end of next week, I will leave to meet up with her in Virginia for a week.
Right.
But so I'm on my own now.
But you probably have a lot to talk about since I was talking so much the last several episodes. You probably have stuff.
Yeah, but I totally have forgotten all of
No, that you don't, because stuff, you probably had stuff you wanted to say about the Dresden Files game and you haven't talked
Dresden
about.
Dresden Files game is going good. We've now had two sessions. The last one had a reporter there.
A reporter?
Yes. Reporter who's doing a paper for an article for the Gazette sort of about the gaming scene around the corridor. As ties into, she's sort of doing a report about Anime Iowa that's coming up.
Oh, are you going to that, Anime Iowa?
Oh, no. I tend not to go to any of them these days.
I wonder if Mark's going. You know, he used to be really heavily involved.
Yeah, they were. I don't know if they... Mark, tell us if you're going to Anime Iowa. Maybe you can give us a special report for the hat on how it is. I think Dan and Lisa are going to go. I don't know. But anyway, so yeah, so we had a reporter there who wasn't really familiar with role-playing games.
Did she ask a lot of questions? Or?
Afterwards, I think she interviewed Lisa and Dan after we left. We ran pretty late.
Why there? I mean, did some she knows one of you guys?
She contacted Lisa. I don't know how she got in contact with Lisa.
She's not friends with her anymore?
I have no idea. What part of I don't know how she got in contact with Lisa do you not understand?
Well, all that means is you don't know if she called or sent an email or...
I don't know why she got in contact with Lisa. How about that?
That's better.
More than just the medium, the circumstances which allowed her to be in knowledge of Lisa so as to contact her are also a mystery to me.
That's really odd, though. I mean, did they act toward one another as if they were friends? Or
actually, no.
Did Lisa introduce her as a friend?
No, and I know they're not friends. At least
I thought you said a second ago.
I just realized it.
Okay.
Freaking Kojak. Hold up here. That's a dated enough reference now.
Kojak.
People probably think I'm talking about the cheese blend.
Yeah, maybe.
No. When she and I were discussing over email about it, because we hadn't gamed, we'd had a break, because they were out of town for a week, and so we couldn't game last Tuesday. And so there was some concern that is this report thing going to take up time? And so I was talking with Lisa back and forth. And in the process, the woman in question is Asian and has a cool Asian name. It's like Karuna or something. Okay. And so when Lisa was telling me about her and said she, and then in parentheses she put, the name is Karuna. I'm assuming that's female, but I suppose it could be male.
Oh,
so at that point, I guess I do realize, yeah, she did not know.
So they're not friends.
The individual.
Does Lisa blog about gaming or something? Or
no, she does some review stuff. She's been associated with people who are heavily associated with Mindbridge, so her name may have come up through that. Hmm. Or the reporter may have posted on some sort of public forum, and Lisa said something.
Or your reputation precedes you.
Possibly. But so yeah, so she was there. The game is going pretty well. It doesn't move really fast, but we've had some interesting stuff already. The players are coming up with weird crap on their own, which I like. Like, I'm really, just in the last week or so, I started reading this book called Play Unsafe, which is a fairly short book about role-playing games. And sort of a method of playing and running them that relies heavily on rules for improvisational games and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it very interesting, and I'm trying to sort of come at it more from this approach now and planning less ahead of time and doing more improvising. Mm-hmm. And that works best if the players are also doing that, and I've been encouraging them very strongly, and they're starting to really come out with this cool stuff, and yeah, lots of things they came up with that I did not expect, and things went in weird directions, but I'm very excited about it, and things that we haven't yet explained that'll come down the road and things like that, and it's all very cool. So I'm starting to, we're still getting in the swing of things, but I'm really, it's just such a different type of play and such a different type of system, and it's really fun. They're currently tracking down a 14-year-old runaway that everybody seems to want to find, and nobody's explaining why, and weird, creepy things are happening. Mm. It's pretty fun. And they already got into a pretty ridiculous fight with a couple of gun-toting thugs.
A fight?
Sort of.
How do you get into a fight with gun-toting thugs?
Well, a gun-toting thug comes up behind you in a dance hall, and not a dance hall, but like a club, and puts a gun in your ribs and says, you need to take a walk with us.
And so then you just do whatever they say. Why do you
fight? You apparently do not. That's kind of what I was expecting, too.
Yeah.
Not so much what happened.
And they didn't get shot?
A shot went off, but did not hit anyone. And they ended up having a little bit of help, because one of them actually yelled out in the middle of the club, kill the lights. And much to her and everyone else's surprise, somebody actually did it.
Oh, wow.
And this is convenient, because said individual is the only person around who can see perfectly in the dark.
Well,
and so, at that point, it became easy. Also, we had a couple of spellcasters upstairs who, once they realized what was going on, did all sorts of terrible things to the gun-toting guys, and then it was not so much of an issue.
Oh, I see.
So one of them actually shot hornets at one of them.
Hornets?
Yeah, he actually cast a spell that basically just conjured a swarm of hornets that just stung the crap out of this guy.
All right, so how many people are playing the game?
Four people.
And what kind of characters are they?
One is playing an apprentice wizard that is sort of a standard model fitting in with Dresden universe.
Okay.
Like a White Council apprentice. He's a little bit different in that he's older than most of them are. His power sort of manifested late. So he's a little bit... His background's slightly... He was a stockbroker. And was that well into his adulthood. And so it's a little bit weird in that he's starting later on those things. One of them is a... basically a kinetomancer. He is... able to work with force and spirit. He's basically telekinetic, for lack of a better term. And is very sort of bitter in life that, to a certain degree, stems from the fact that he manifested his powers really early, and part of the things that happen when you're a spellcaster in Dresden Universe is that technology doesn't work for you.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, he grew up in this day and age and yet couldn't really work with computers or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And so he was sort of cut out from a lot of society that way and has become sort of bitter and is very much sort of a blue-collar worker. He works on restoring old cars and things like that, but has issues with trusting people and stuff like that.
Mm.
One very tormented orphan, who's not anymore, who's now in fact a librarian, actually refers to herself as a cybrarian because she's
very big. So wait, when you stop being an orphan, you become a librarian?
Well, she eventually became a librarian. Here's the thing.
She's
was
still an orphan, though, really.
She was a tormented orphan in that her parents died, and then she went into foster homes, and the families kept dying.
Because of her, or...?
Well, she has no idea.
Oh.
And on top of that, around puberty, she started being able to see the dead. And this got her put in an institution and medicated and all sorts of things. And she eventually got out of that by learning to basically lie about the problem.
Oh.
And then eventually became a librarian. That was her actual interest. And made friends with a ghost in a library already, that where she now works. Now, the story behind that, that none of us know in-game, but that is built into it, is she is actually the illegitimate daughter of Hades, god of the underworld.
That's kind of inconvenient.
Well, and she doesn't know her history. She knows there's something weird about her, but she doesn't know what. But in reality, yes, she's the daughter of Hades, and in fact, her family and all the other ones have been killed by Persephone.
In a fit of jealousy?
Yes, and her mother worked out a deal with Persephone. Her mother, who is now down in the underworld, worked out a deal with Persephone to not tell Hades about the kid as long as she wouldn't harm the kid. And so Persephone kept that deal and instead just killed everybody around her and made her life a living hell. Uh-huh. But all of this stuff is not yet known to the character. Lisa built all of this stuff in there, but it hasn't actually, like, it's behind-the-scenes stuff the character doesn't know, and hopefully will come out in fascinating and awesome ways.
Hmm.
And then the last character is a snobby rich kid who had dreams of being becoming a writer. Unfortunately, he's not very good at it. And in his attempts, he ended up basically making a deal with the Summer Court of Faerie to basically work for them in exchange for magical powers that he hoped would make him a better writer, and it has turned out that he's still a shitty writer.
Mm.
He can now do magical powers. He's a scriptomancer, and he can cast spells and shit, but he's still a pretty shitty writer.
Mm.
And so the way they get what they want out of him is he's essentially a talent broker for them, for lack of a better term. He finds actual creative people, which the Summer Court really want. They like to feed off of that creativity, and puts them in touch with fairies and gets them to make a deal. So, yeah, he's very unhappy, and he's a scumbag who sort of deep down sort of is wanting to change, which is part of why he hangs out with the other PCs.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point sort of doesn't see how, so he's just kind of an asshole.
Hmm.
And very rich and privileged. And a fascinating character. If I was going to play one of the characters, I would play that one, I think.
Hmm.
But they're all very cool. The apprentice one sounds the most boring, but he's actually got ties, and he's from an immigrant family, and he was raised by them, and there's a whole thing there, because his family thinks he's still a stockbroker and doesn't know about this other shit, and hmm. he's actually kind of uncomfortable about how that's going to come out, and...
Hmm.
So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on there. So we're playing that. I'm still playing Mass Effect 3.
Mm-hmm.
I'm becoming obsessed with Skyrim, even though I have not purchased it or played it.
Well, then how are you becoming...
I've been listening to this podcast. It's about video games, and I'm starting from the beginning, so it's a while back.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just gotten at the point where Skyrim is big, and they won't shut up about it. And it's really driving me crazy, but I'm determined not... I'm not going to play it anytime soon.
Mm.
Like, it'll at least be 2013. Before I play Skyrim. But that's sort of been in my head a lot lately. I'm excited about that way in the future. But still playing Mass Effect 3, still really, really liking it.
The game that's been played in our household recently is BioShock and BioShock 2.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Great, great games
because,
that I can't play.
Because we've pre-ordered BioShock
Infinity.
Yeah, and but, you know, nobody'd ever played the first two games.
Oh.
What happened was we downloaded a demo or something, and, you know, the other adult in my household played it and liked it, so she immediately pre-ordered it and then realized, well, golly, I haven't played, you know, the first two BioShocks, so we got those because they're not very expensive right now.
No, it's been forever.
And she really liked them, but this game that's coming isn't really going to be anything like these, so...
Well, it's not in the continuity, per se, but then again, in some ways, neither was BioShock 2.
Well, it was in the same place.
Yeah, sort of.
Wasn't the same character, but...
Yeah, and BioShock Infinite is theoretically... I mean, it may tie in. They're not telling us too much, but yeah.
Which I'm kind of surprised, because she usually likes, you know, RPGs and... You know, playing a game where you don't create the character and it doesn't give it its own name or whatever, where you're actually, like in BioShock, it barely even made any sense because it's not like your character ever spoke or anything.
No.
Well, and for that matter, in BioShock 2. But I think in this third one, your character is going to say things, but you don't it's not a role-playing game. It's a...
No, but it's very compelling narrative and very...
No, that's true.
Very impressive visually.
Yes, yes, that's right.
But, I mean, it is a first-person shooter.
Yes, it is. And it I guess the BioShock and BioShock 2 are in the horror genre, which I thought was interesting. But part of that, I think, is because, you know, when you play it, it's supposed to have... The lighting is supposed to be low, and they probably imagine you playing it mostly on a PC in the dark and stuff, and it probably would be kind of scary, but here we are in the living room on a console, and she doesn't like when the lighting's low, so she turns it all the way up, and so it wasn't really very creepy or scary, but I can imagine how it would be if you played it the right way.
I would have put it more in a sci-fi genre than a horror, but I can see why. I wouldn't have chosen that, but I can see why somebody might think that. It has, I mean, I read up on it and stuff when I found out I couldn't play it, because people say it's so amazing. At least the first one. People are more mixed about the second one, but...
Well, the second one is, the first one was kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say it was groundbreaking, but there was something new about it.
And
I mean,
the narrative of the second one very much feels like a what do we do now?
Yeah, right.
They weren't planning that sequel, but it was so successful, they're like, we got to come up with a story.
Well, it worked for my household because it was like when the first one ended, it was almost disappointing. So you plug in the second one, and it's almost like the first one didn't really end.
You're
playing a different kind of character, but it's all still first person. It all feels the same. It all looks the same. It's like, oh. So, you know, I played the first one. I really liked it, and I'm sad it's over. Oh, here I can basically keep playing the first game.
Yeah.
So it was fine. But if she'd anticipated, like, 2 or 3 years to play this brand new game, and then it was just like the first one, she might have felt different about it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm expecting that as soon as I finish Mass Effect 3, I'm probably going to do Assassin's Creed Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. And from what I have heard, it's sort of Assassin's Creed 2.5. Like, in terms of gameplay, it's very similar to Assassin's Creed 2. And I'm fine with that, because I loved that game. Yeah, I think the way it's going to go for me right now is I finish Mass Effect 3, then I do Assassin's Creed Brotherhood, then I maybe tackle Final Fantasy 13, which I'm wary about, but I have it, so. But we'll see how long that takes me. If Christmas comes around, I might get new games from that.
So, Mass Effect games in general, and maybe 3 in particular, what are they like? Like, you know, Dragon Age and Dragon Age 2 were both fairly... you had some side quests, but for the most part, it led you right through the game. Are the Mass Effect games any more kind of... I know they're not open like, say, some Bethesda games are, but is it more... Do you have more side quests and more little things
to make it... Absolutely.
Make it not feel like you're being directed?
Well, yes and no. Here's the deal. And they do it a little bit differently in each of the three, but it comes down to the same concept. Mm-hmm. In each game, you have a quest log, like everything else, and they basically tell you, these are the quests that will make the game move forward.
Forward, yeah.
And then you have a bunch of others. And outside of that, at no point in general, with one exception I will note, at no point is your movement ever restricted. Like, you can go throughout the known galaxy and go to any planet you want. Hmm. Some of them are not that interesting. Some of them you just sort of wander around and find resources and crap. Hmm. But you can go wherever you want. In Mass Effect 3, and I don't remember this from Mass Effect 2, the priority missions, the game is very much sort of built in acts. Mm-hmm. And so I have my priority missions.
Yeah.
And once I do those, things sort of change and I'm into a new act. And one of the side effects of that is there are parts... Each time that happens, there are new systems in the galaxy that are open to me that weren't before.
Yeah. Dragon Age 2 is kind
of
like that.
But outside of that, no, it's very... You very much know what is going to move the plot forward, but it's very open. And the first one has a fair bit of role-playing elements. The second one, less so. It's more into the narrative. And the third one, even more so. But by the time we hit the third... The big thing is it's not... It is a role-playing game. But that's not where its big strengths lie. It has put together a deep, intricate, and compelling story.
Mm-hmm.
With, especially in the third one, the dialogue I love. And even overheard dialogue. a lot of quests you get because you happen to overhear somebody complaining about they need, like, this piece of equipment doesn't work. I really need something that's more like this. And then it's in your quest log. If you find something more like that, get it. And just fast, there's a whole bunch of things where you'll pass by these people and they'll have a snippet of conversation. And then if you leave and go do something else, next time you come back, that conversation will continue. Mm-hmm. And some really interesting conversations that take place, but you have to keep coming back and things like that. And lots of things with your squad mates. If you go after each mission, it's good to go around and talk to them and stuff. And like I said, the big thing is literally decisions you made in the first game will have enormous impact in the up all the way through the third game.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I was amazed because the third game, you're preparing sort of for war, and that's part of the thing. And you have there's a place you go and you can see the breakdown of what war assets you have. And certain assets will change, like you do this, and so now suddenly this army has more people, or this army has less, or whatever. And there were a couple that it had updates just when I started, and I'm like, what? And I'm realizing, oh, these are things that affected these assets back in the first game when we weren't at war yet. But it's saying, like, because you did this, they lost a bunch of ships, and they haven't been able to replace them in the 3 years since you did that thing. And I'm like, well, shit.
If only I'd know.
But then it's true, because it's like, because you saved this ship, it's here to fight for you now, and by the way, it's a badass.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so there's all sorts of fascinating trade-offs. It does, like the old-fashioned BioWare games, it's not good and evil, it's Paragon and Renegade.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is that thing again, which honestly, as groundbreaking as it was back in the KOTOR days and stuff, I'm getting tired of it.
Mm.
I much prefer the Fallout 3 Dragon Age model where your decisions have impacts, but we aren't going to label them.
Like reputation and...
Well, or just like shit you do, like then, you know, like...
That's
you,
consequences.
In a civil war, you side with this guy, so those people die, mm-hmm. or whatever.
Right, right.
As opposed to saying you did the good thing or you did the bad thing, because it's always imperfect.
Yeah, right.
KOTOR, you could get away with the fact that arguably in Star Wars, the whole light side, dark side thing is very strict and arbitrary and not necessarily correspond to philosophically good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
But in other games, there's stuff that I'm like, I feel awful about. Like, I made the good decision by telling the truth. I also broke up this marriage. And I'm not, you know, just weird shit like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, or like, I didn't help the homeless guy because he was lying, but he's going to die in the cold. And I'm like, you know, it's just like, a lot of stuff that you're like, it really depends on your perspective whether this was the good thing or the bad thing. And that's why this tried to do a little more Paragon versus Renegade, and it's more working within the system and trying to bring people together versus being ruthless or doing your own shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, your goals are still the same. It's just how you go about
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
It's not one of those where, like, are you going to become the archvillain and control the galaxy, or are you going to be the hero and save the galaxy? Either way, you're saving the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, are you doing it in that vigilante badass way, or are you doing it as, you know, the paragon of justice and things? But yeah, no, you guys need to play it.
Well.
And maybe do it on PC, I don't know. But if for no other reason, your family specifically, the other adult in your family very much prefers to play female protagonists.
Yes.
And those tend to be in the minority.
Hmm.
And on top of that, not only is this a female protagonist, it is a completely voice-acted female protagonist with unique dialogue that you can't get for the male protagonist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, for that experience alone, you should do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great game. Anyway. It's a great series of games anyway.
Right, right. Yeah, we should probably do that. Just for fun.
If I was going away on a longer trip, I'd just lend you my Xbox 360 and you could play.
Yeah, that the problem, of course, is, you know, it's not a big deal to go get the first one and play it on the PC, but
if you want to carry it over, you have to play the whole series
on the same platform.
And they didn't make Mass Effect 1 for the PlayStation 3.
No, so...
I find that ridiculous. Why didn't you just port it over? It couldn't have been that tough. People would have bought it.
I suppose we could just play it all on the PC. That'd be very unusual, but we played Knights of the Old Republic, two different Knights of the Old Republic.
One thing you might have to watch out for is whether or not your PC could support it all.
Well, Abby's isn't that old. It's like, she's only had it for a year.
I know, but like this machine? Mm-hmm. Couldn't do it.
Well, I mean...
It needs a graphics card that makes it a gaming machine.
Well, she's got that.
Okay. Then you should be okay. I recently discovered I can't play Skyrim on this, which made me sad. Oh. My old gaming machine, I needed a graphics card twice as good as the one in that one to meet the minimum requirements for Skyrim. Because I thought it might be nice to do Skyrim on my PC and not be constantly taking up the television with it when I play it 20 hours a day for 6 months. But...
Well, and there are a lot of advantages to playing a game like that on a PC. There's lots of, you know, cheat codes
and
stuff.
Mods and things.
And mods, yeah.
But I think Trish is going to play too, so that's good.
Okay.
The podcast I'm listening to is a husband and wife, and they actually play together, and they're doing that in Skyrim. Like, they have one character, and they're playing it together. And so part of me is like, we could do... I'm like, no, we could never do that. Like, there's too many... The parts that interest me aren't the parts that interest her, and I want to play the game very differently than hers, but... We're over a half hour, so
okay.
Maybe some hatness would be nice.
Might be good. That's why we're here. That's why they listen.
They listen because we tell them to listen. Although, weirdly, we tell them on the podcast, so they couldn't hear us tell them unless they were already listening. It's a weird cycle. Is it from Roger Dallin?
No, it's from the producer.
Oh, the producer.
I don't know if you want me to read this.
Is it about my penis? I hate when she writes into the hat about my penis.
No, then I wouldn't want to read it.
Well, there we go. What's it say?
Okay, are you ready? I mean...
Lay it on me. I'm married to the woman. You can't shock me.
That's the whole point. My dearest hat.
Yeah, no. That's fine.
Is there something going on there?
Quite possibly.
You didn't know about and I just...
No, there's lots of pieces of headwear that she's
okay.
had flings with.
Our
marriage is cool like that.
Okay, I don't want to talk about it. Please ask my husband... Hat doesn't talk. So I guess I have to do it. Please ask my husband to explain what he believes to be the rules of knocking on wood. Love, the producer.
Ah... Knocking on wood is tricky.
Is there something behind this question?
I'm sure there was at the time it was written.
But you don't know?
No, I don't recall. This is tricky, though, and this comes up more in this day and age. Because it's difficult to knock on wood in that a lot of things that look like wood are not, in fact, wood. Used to run into this when we worked at Applied. You couldn't knock on wood on the desk because the desk was not wood. Underneath the desk was particle board, which is technically wood.
Right, but you also need to think about where this practice originally came from. It was like a superstition, like throwing salt over your shoulder or whatever. But wasn't it about the spirits in the wood or? I guess I don't remember. Do you remember what knocking on wood?
No, you're our regional.
Oh, I thought you knew this.
Nerd. No.
Knocking on wood. Okay, someone actually should look this up who's listening and post on the blog, but if recollection serves, it's something like you say something and or something you hope to happen. But when you say knock on wood, it means that, you know, that it hasn't happened yet and things could prevent it from happening, but you hope it doesn't prevent it from happening, basically. I mean, that's what you knock on wood
for,
right?
I've always thought that was the premise, yeah.
Right. And knocking on wood meaning the spirits in the wood that might have other designs on what you want to happen, you knock on wood and that prevents them from...
So you're essentially punching them
and
saying, stay down!
It's like... You know, there's a superstition among some cultures or some people that if you speak what your plans are, you're letting potentially nefarious forces know what you're planning so that they'll know how to stop you or meddle in your affairs.
So really, the sum total of your hopes, dreams, and desires are like one giant birthday wish?
Or something. I don't know.
Don't say it out loud or it won't come
true. So when you knock on wood, that somehow, I don't know, prevents them from, I don't know if it keeps them in there so they don't come out, or it forces them out so that they can't mess with your plans.
Or, maybe
it's telling them, hey, you guys, help me out with this. I don't remember what it is, but somehow...
Maybe you're supposed to knock while you're saying it, and the noise distracts them.
Something like that. But it's about spirits living in the wood, I believe. So, I don't know how much, you know, how the spirits would survive the particle board production process.
This is the thing, yeah. It's like, and in a given bit, am I knocking on an actual piece of wood, or am I knocking on one of the spots that's mostly glue?
Yeah, well, and I guess the point to me telling this story, probably wrong, and again, please correct me if I got it wrong, is that it does matter if it's wood. It's not just a trivial thing. Like,
I've always felt that.
It's not like knock on the table and they just said wood. No, it's specifically, I mean, yeah. If you're standing next to a tree, you could say it, should say it.
The saying isn't like knock on whatever crap is handy.
Well,
although,
but
maybe we should start that.
But that's what people do. You know, they'll... And I think...
I know, and I hate them.
I think sometimes they get the impression that it just happens to be what was handy was made of wood, and that's why people say that. But no.
Back in olden times, everything around you was wood. And so by saying knock on wood, you essentially meant knock on my immediate environment, because all your environment was wood.
Exactly.
In the olden days.
In the olden times, yes.
Yes, in your...
But it does have to be wood. And I would say... From, you know, I think it's reasonable to expect that it should be like real wood, not particle board or simulated wood. Or
how does varnished wood work, or finished at all, you know? Because technically you're not coming in contact with the wood.
Well,
and is that the thing? Is it the skin on grain that, like, could I knock on wood with a hammer?
It doesn't matter what you knock on the wood with.
So it doesn't have to be my...
No,
skin.
No.
So then by that token,
again,
it should be able to go through varnish.
Well, yeah, I don't think varnish or anything. I mean, as long as it's wood,
even
the spirits can live in there.
Finish?
Yeah.
Oh, so the important part is, okay. So the important part is the wood in the real wood that has spirits in it.
Yeah.
So theoretically, if I had a block of wood and it was encased inside a... sphere of lead, and I hit it.
Yeah, I'm with
a hammer.
I'm pretty sure lead doesn't stop the spirits.
All right, so if I. So.
However, grinding the wood up into chips and then gluing it back together as a wood product. I mean, for example, do you think the wood spirits are surviving in this piece of paper?
That's a very good question. Can we knock on paper or on non-corrugated cardboard?
No, I don't think so.
So okay, so there's something about the intrinsic woodness of it.
I mean, and I'd hate to be the one to decide how large a piece of wood...
Well, and at what point does wood stop being wood processed?
Like a wood chip, obviously, is still wood, I suppose. And if particle board is wood chips, I guess it's valid to knock on that, I suppose. Because there's wood chips in there.
And theoretically...
But see, paper's made of pulp. I mean, it's pulverized. There's got to be a difference there. But particle board has actual chunks of wood in it. It does.
If I stomp
most of it does
on the ground hard enough to make the ground shake a little bit, and it's near a tree, so that theoretically the vibrations hit the tree, does that count?
No.
How is that different from me taking a hammer... to the sphere of lead that in its center
has
the, wood.
The tool, the sphere of lead that in its center has wood.
Yes, from my earlier figure. If you look on page
four, because you're
you'll
just
see.
You're just because if you stomp on the ground, it's just the vibrations of your stomping. I mean,
you could say I am knocking the wood through the ground via my feet, as I am knocking the wood through the lead via my hammer.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. But at least the hammer is touching the thing that's... Well, but your foot is touching the ground, so I don't know.
Yeah, I'm doing this barefoot.
You're doing it
I'm
barefoot.
I'm not wearing shoes.
Well, that shouldn't matter.
Does it have to be conductive?
No, no. Okay, okay. Going back,
is it metal versus?
I'm getting confused, and it's really quite simple.
What if I'm in a pool with wood chips?
No. It's really quite simple. If you disturb the wood in any way, yes, stomping on the ground, if the vibrations make it to the roots, whatever, that will accomplish the same thing. The whole point isn't that you're doing a particular kind of disturbing of the wood. The point is you're disturbing it somehow. Yell at it, for all I care. But whatever you're doing, it is stirring up the spirits in the wood, whatever that means.
That's going to be my new saying. I'm going to say, I hope it comes through. Yell at wood.
But something about knocking on the wood does something to the spirits in the wood that does something to either prevent the thing you want to happen from being prevented, or it helps the thing actually come to be.
So we have a broad mandate in terms of disturbing the wood.
Mm-hmm.
The real restrictions here have to do with the definition of wood.
Yeah, kind of.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. But that said, working within the context of superstition, you know, better safe than sorry. So, you know, if there's any ambiguity about whether or not it qualifies as wood, just go with it. Because if there's spirits in this little piece of paper that can help me, well, you know, I'm going to knock on it. I mean, what could it hurt? If there's spirits in this little piece of paper that are going to hurt me, if that's what it's about, being hurt by the spirits, then I'm going to do that too. You know, you see what I'm saying? Because when it comes to superstition, it's all about can't hurt, right? That's sort of the philosophy.
When you wish upon a tree.
So the point is, in any situation where you're talking about something that's going to happen, and something that's going to happen, and you,
or that you hope will happen,
well, that you expect is going to happen, or that you're responsible for happening,
barring trouble from any wood spirits,
right,
will happen.
Right. So you knock on wood in order to, you know, prevent it from, well, not happening. And if you are worried that anything around you that has even the slightest trace of wood in it. Also harbors a spirit, then you should knock on it.
So it's not the magic of knocking on wood that aids in something happens. It's the magic of knocking on wood that stops that particular piece of wood from fucking with your plan.
Or something. I can't remember. But that's what I want.
This is a strange bit of paranoia.
Well, but it's like tossing salt over your shoulder or whatever else.
It could have been really good, but the damn pieces of wood were all out to get
me. No, the spirits in the wood.
I know, but so like my...
But like I said, I don't remember if they're helping you or hurting you, but one way or the other, you're supposed to knock on wood so that the thing you're talking about will either come to pass or not be prevented from coming to pass.
In elementary school, when I was in elementary school, our playground was full of wood chips on the ground. That was 1970s and 80s definition of how not to hurt kids, was to give them all these bits of wood to fall on. And it was more or less successful, but you could hurt yourself with wood too. So were I to confess my hopes and dreams while standing in that playground, I could spend years having to knock on each piece of wood.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Hundreds of thousands. This might be where yelling comes in handy. I just would yell at the playground.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you think that'll work, it'll work. That's how superstition works.
I find that I think very little of this will work at all. So
don't believe in wood spirits?
I am less than concerned that wood spirits are conspiring to thwart my ambitions.
Or help them, either way.
Well, if it's a matter of helping, it's less of a loss. I have faith that my plans and goals in life still have a fairly decent chance of success without the aid of wood spirits.
Okay, well, you're probably right about that.
I mean, sometimes I wonder. I say to myself, when I didn't get the job, when I spent 2 years unemployed, there were times when I came home and I'm like...
But, you know, of course, the saying... These days, the saying is more or less sort of a homespun way of saying, you know, barring any unforeseen circumstances, this is what's going to happen.
Love
or hoping nothing bad happens to interfere with these plans, this is what's going to happen. But it comes from... It comes from the superstition that spirits in the wood are going to help or hinder you. I don't remember which.
Project should be done by next week. Yell at wood. Yeah, so here's what I'm really hoping to get out of this. I'm hoping that what you have described in this whole process is completely wrong and utter bullshit. And that one of our listeners will know the truth and will tell us about it. Because that would amuse the hell out of me.
Especially since we spent so much time on it.
Exactly.
You know, it makes
that we've come up with this elaborate system that I'm hoping somebody has some evidence that is just complete and utter bullshit.
It reminds me, though, of another superstition that I recently learned about.
Well, did you give a mouse a cookie?
No, I didn't just learn about it, but I learned more about it recently that... for a while, at least in European cultures, maybe other cultures too, the evil eye was something people were really afraid of. To the extent that they, you know, you didn't take a newborn baby into public because someone might be envious.
Yeah, yeah.
And that would make some bad things happen to it. So there were lots of ways to ward off the evil eye. Because that's, you know, and people who were supposed to be especially attractive were worried that someone would look at them enviously and then they'd have a bad luck.
I used to worry about that. But you want to know what happened?
What happened?
Somebody gave me the evil eye, and now I look like this. So while it does justify my worry, no longer an issue. This is what happened, and it's over now. Now, the best I can hope for is maybe somebody will give me the sexy eye, and then...
But isn't that interesting? I mean, why would people associate someone looking at you with envy with actually causing you harm or bad luck?
Because people love to feel victimized.
It's very strange. I mean, if you know...
If looks good kill?
The belief in spirits, I think I've got a pretty good understanding of how that evolved in humanity, how that could persist even until more recent times, and then superstitions. That's fine. But the notion that bad luck befalls somebody and it occurs to them that someone gave them a dirty look a week ago and that's what caused this, I mean, that seems incredible.
The human capacity to draw connections via coincidence is
no, I realize enormous. That, but why not draw the coincidence between... If you're going to draw the coincidence between something that's clearly not connected, but, you know, you're paranoid or whatever, why not? Because, you know, I don't know, because you saw a certain animal that day, which is often the case.
Which can be a thing, too, but there is a tremendous amount of emotional impact tied up in...
Oh, receiving a looks. Dirty look from somebody.
Exactly.
Yeah, yes,
people
yes.
can give you looks that just,
Yeah, you're right.
Mess with your head.
You're right.
And if you didn't see, I mean, maybe you saw some animals, but as long as they were fairly standard things you see every day, then you wouldn't put that together.
Like a goat. Or
and
something.
We're talking about thousands of years of history here, so it just has to happen to a couple people who are convincing enough, and they tell other people, and then somebody heard it from somebody. And
well,
then,
and of course, I'm totally ignoring the fact that someone might claim that that's why they're having it. Like, oh, you know why you're having bad luck? Because I gave you the evil eye, and...
And look at it this way.
I guess I didn't think of that. That's possible.
And this is maybe a bad question to ask you because you don't know nothing. But
no, I don't.
How many people out there in Western society believe that over your lifetime, while you sleep, you will swallow an average of 8 spiders?
Well, lots of people believe that.
Yes. And that was just a decade ago invented... by somebody writing something about the ridiculousness of believing stuff.
Right.
And so in that short a period of time, something that was not even anybody trying to convince anybody of everything, but somebody specifically making as ridiculous a point as they can about gullibility has become a thing that lots of people believe. And so when you take hundreds, if not thousands of years of people who are actually trying to convince people of things, of course it's there. And of course, only certain people believe it. And mostly Europeans, because...
Yeah, right, right.
They drink a lot more than we do.
Yeah. Well,
most of the time.
A lot of that stuff was brought over here, too. But, you know,
along with a lot of dead spiders in people's stomachs.
Yeah. I don't know... Yeah. Well, I don't know why I've become so familiar with some of these things. Although, like you just pointed out, maybe I'm completely wrong. Maybe I've read some site where someone was just making it all up.
Somebody gave you the evil eye.
Although I've read most of this in books, so.
Of the knock on wood thing.
Well, like I said, most of this I've read, so.
So it must be true.
Well, no. This is all the stuff I was supposed to use to make my granny magic stuff plausible, and it didn't really work out.
No, you know why? I gave you the evil eye.
That's right. You gave me the evil eye and messed it all up.
It's this one. It's not this one. This one's the allergic eye. All right. Well, if we hurry, we can get another question in.
Okay. How are we doing on questions? Should more people write in and stuff?
People should always write in to themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That is themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Write in with a question or a topic. It will make us happy.
Unless you're Azure Talon.
Yes. If you're Azure Talon, fuck you. This one is from Blood Sparrow.
Yay. It's been a long time since we got one from her.
No preamble. She gets right to the point.
Right to the point.
What is it about clowns? Why do people think they are creepy? Pennyworth aside.
Well, you know, Pennyworth aside, I mean that the whole reason of Pennyworth is because people already found them creepy.
Clowns are creepy.
I don't know. My mom liked clowns, and we had clown, you know, decoration stuff around our house. So, and I never thought any of it was creepy, and I didn't really get the idea about clowns being creepy until I came to college, and I have a picture. I have a painting with clowns in it that my mom gave me that
and your roommate killed three people after he saw it.
No, he just thought it was creepy as all. He didn't like it.
I absolutely understand it. And I think the concept is very, when you think about clowns as a construct, I think it makes entirely too much sense. First of all, there's a decidedly inhuman factor in them. They're people, but they're not quite. They look different. They have these big mouths.
Clown,
they have funny noses.
I mean,
let's
face it. Clowns are... It's grotesque is what it is.
Yes,
I mean,
it is grotesque in the very traditional sense of the word.
Yes.
On top of that, there is this concept of sort of forced happiness built into it. I know there are exceptions in clowns. There's a sad sack version of clown.
Mm.
But in general, the clown literally has a smile pasted on its face and is just sort of manically happy. And then you add the layer of masquerade to it. The part of you don't really know who's behind the makeup. And I mean, and this is very literally true because I've seen people made up as clowns. And so many people, like people that you knew, if they were made up as clowns, like professionally, you would not recognize them.
Yeah, especially if they did it well.
And so when you add in the incognito aspect, the grotesque aspect, and the weird sort of artificial jocularity, artificial manic joy, yeah, it's off. It's the whole concept becomes rather grotesque.
I suppose. But it's clearly, I mean, in most cases, I mean, in the archetypical cases, it's comic grotesque. I mean, it's like the person's like a walking cartoon character. I mean,
yeah.
Which there's a dark side to that. But it's not a comic dark side. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, it's slapstick and comic violence and stuff like that. It's
well, and here we get into the concept that clown, in its traditional definition, has nothing to do with this shit. A clown is a part one plays in the Commedia dell'arte that can be accompanied by flamboyant costume and makeup, but that's not part of the definition. Clown is defined by the role they play, which is why you can look at certain, for example, Shakespeare plays, and there are characters who are the clown. It does not mean that in the production of the play they are supposed to be in funny wig and floppy shoes.
No, that's true. And that cultural use of the term still exists today in things like class clown and things like that.
And I think the other is an outgrowth of that.
Well, possibly.
It's not that original concept. That people are not scared of the clown role in a play.
But surely that's not what Bloodsparrow is talking about. She's talking
exactly.
about the made-up.
But that's what I'm saying. The concepts you're talking about of
slapstick
and
but that does go along with the painted person. I mean, that is what...
Yes, that's a holdover. But, I mean, I think the parts that make the painted person creepy are the opposite of vestigial, basically. The new outgrowth, the mutations that have come about since then.
Well, I think all those things you're saying kind of feed into it, I suppose, but it seems like you're taking certain elements of the archetype and over-dramatizing them. I mean, there's a lot of things you could take elements like that of and blow them up and then make them creepy. I mean, but of course people do that with like dolls. A lot of people think dolls are creepy.
Well, and keep in mind, finding clowns creepy is not universal.
But it's true for a lot of people. It really is. And it's strange.
Well, and for me, I mean, because if some say, do you find clowns creepy? I would probably say yes. But the reality is, most of the times I see a clown, not a big deal.
I don't think
but
they're not creepy to me. I can understand how they are to other people.
They can be used in such a way that, even unintentionally, that will freak me the fuck out.
Right, but part of that is... isn't part of that, though, when they do that? Isn't part of that that you're taking something that's not supposed to be creepy and you're making it creepy? And, like, in that case, it's not that it has some kind of innate creepiness that they're capitalizing on. It's that they're taking something that's supposed to be, you know, child-friendly and the kind of thing you would call to entertain your children at a birthday party, and it's out killing people. I mean, that's what makes it creepy.
No, but I'm talking about in situations that are even unintentional. Situations that in no way mean to be creepy, if the circumstances are right, will totally freak me out. Other situations with clowns, no.
Well, like what?
I can't think of... Some clowns freak me out more than others. My closest, most recent experience with a clown that I can think of is on the show Modern Family, the sitcom. One of the characters was a children's party clown, and there are certain episodes that come up with an excuse for him to dress up as a clown again, and I don't find that clown creepy at all. And it's a full-on thing. It's got a wig and all that jazz. But then there are other clowns. Totally freak me out. I mean, I was, as a child, there was a parade in my town, like there tend to be in most towns. They come up with some specific holiday associated with that town, and they have a parade for it. And we had one. Back in those days, it was called the Kaiser Days, because we lived in Kaiser. Now it's called the Iris Days. But my sister was in high school, and...
Sling Blade.
Yeah.
Some people call it a Sling Blade. I call it the Kaiser Blade.
I call it Iris Days. Oh, that's hilarious. I really gotta make use of that. I like that. Oh, I'm going to use that next time I go home. And next time, like, my sister mentions the Iris Days Parade, I'm going to say, some people call it Iris Days, I call it Kaiser Days. I don't know if you've seen Sling Blade, though, so I don't know if that'll work.
French fried potatoes.
But, so, my sister's in high school, and a friend, really even sort of an acquaintance of her, but she knew him through theater, and I knew him because I was the little kid. My mom was the theater mom in high school, and I was the little kid that came with. So I knew him, and he's a clown, and he comes by us, and I know it's him, and he picks me up and starts carrying me away. And I lost my mind, and like 10 feet later, he had to put me down and let me run back to my parents. Hmm. Because he was done up as a clown, and it just freaked me out.
Nah, I've never been freaked out by clowns. You know, something else, this is that some people are freaked out by, not just by dolls, but also by puppets. Marionettes, yeah. Ventriloquist puppets especially. Ventriloquist puppets are a little creepy. Or they can be.
Oh, yeah.
But a lot of people are creeped out by that stuff. But I've always been entertained by those things. I'm one of those
dolls,
kids.
Dolls also freak people out.
If I was picked up by a clown or something, I would thought that was great when I was a kid. I've never been creeped out by these things. But I'm still not really sure. I mean, all the things you mentioned, I get it. But I still don't. There seems to be some ingredient there that I still don't understand that makes a person get creeped out by these things.
Well, people.
Is it the dead eyes in a doll that bothers somebody? Or is that what it reminds them of, a dead person? Or
I think in the case of dolls and puppets and things, I think it may be the idea that the general creepiness of an inanimate object becoming animate. And when something looks like a living thing, and specifically a person, that possibility, for lack of a better term, becomes more likely.
Well, I wonder if that,
like,
contributes.
Technically, I'd be scared if the table came to life.
No, right, but I wonder
if when you have an inanimate object that actually looks like a little dude, it seems way more likely that he'll come to life.
Well, I wonder if that's part of the problem with the clown too, because the clown does not. The thing about clowns, at least in Western culture, maybe just American culture, I don't know, is that you know, for one thing, you often can't tell if the person who's made up as a clown is male or female.
Yeah.
And you know, they're the tone of their skin isn't natural. So basically, from a particular perspective, it can look like something that's not human.
Yes.
But is nevertheless walking around
and doing shit
and doing stuff
really flamboyantly and assertively,
yeah.
If not aggressively.
So maybe it's the same kind of, maybe it's the same sense of this thing, which I'm perceiving somehow as a thing and not as a person, is moving around, and, yeah. And I'm not comfortable with that.
I keep wanting to reference the Uncanny Valley in animation, and I can't quite get there.
Well,
it's
maybe,
the reverse
maybe
of that.
It's that.
The traditional clown, before we did the painted person and stuff, was a silly, slapsticky person. The modern clown, silly and slapsticky, not really a person in certain people's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it creepy. They're alien.
Yeah, right. Well, and so would be the doll and the puppet and all
yes,
the stuff.
Yes, yes.
That's something that's like alien in the sense of not human, but still having some, giving you the sense that they have some semblance of intelligence, which means if it's not human, but it's intelligent, can I trust it?
Yeah.
Is it watching me? Is it waiting for me to fall asleep so it can attack me?
Well, and it's the ultimate us and them.
Yeah.
It's not a person, but it can still do shit.
Yeah, yeah. So why wouldn't it?
Or who, what
will it do?
It's completely untrustworthy.
Yeah.
Because it's not a person.
Yeah. So.
Like, technically, I don't trust the table, but the table has very little it can do to me, so it's not an issue.
Do you think that us versus them thing, which, as you're talking about it, I'm becoming more convinced that that's probably what's really at the root of all this. How does that get communicated to you know, human beings so young? You know, how are kids so suspicious of outsiders so early on, rather than being trusting? Like,
well,
apparently I was a very trusting kid.
It becomes about ego boundaries, I think.
So it's just an idiosyncratic thing? Like, some kids are just that way?
But a lot of ego boundaries are determined in your early years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you're born with it, but early on, concepts of self and concepts of community get ingrained in certain ways.
But what's the reason of drawing these boundaries? You know, I mean, you can be taught, say, racism and to not like the neighbors or the other side of the family or whatever. But you know, it seems like a more generic kind of thing when it's just the other, you know, a clown or a doll or whatever is just the other. How does that, and why does it, why do some people when they're very young draw these boundaries and others don't?
Well, it probably comes up as issues of trust, which vary in your upbringing. How important is it when you're young to know who you can trust and who you can't? And in each family and in each community, it's going to be different.
Well, in each individual, too. Because, yes. Like, maybe a child who was left with a neighbor was traumatized by that, some kind of abandonment thing, but the other child didn't care.
Yeah. And I think because, I'm not saying this has to be as a universal truth, but because of the way humans operate, at least in society, as far as we've seen so far, this whole duality idea that humans always have to have, it always has to be this way, black and white kind of thing, has to be two sides. You cannot begin to grasp concepts of trust without there being an opposite. And that's not to say you have to pick somebody not to trust, but cognitively speaking, you cannot understand the concept of trusting someone unless you inherently also understand the concept that it's possible not to trust.
You really think that's true?
I think it is the way society is currently built. I think that's true. Society is built on a dualistic concept.
Okay, but
I lament that fact.
You're right about that. Society is built on that concept, yes. But I can imagine a young child who maybe hasn't been conditioned to think that way yet, thinking, my parents are kind to me and they do great things for me. So big people in general, you know, I can assume that big people in general are nice, and I'm just going to trust. You know, I suppose it's not a choice to trust them. You just automatically do because big people.
And if it becomes articulated to that degree, my argument would be that the seed would be planted then that the bigger you are, the more trustworthy you are, and the smaller you are, the less. But here's the thing. I am not saying that a child could not, in this society, at an early age, trust everyone. What I'm saying is a child in a situation where that's the case isn't even aware of the concept of trust.
I suppose. That's a fair
because idea. It is the natural state. But when you articulate, here's somebody with whom you can put in faith and trust, that concept doesn't work unless the concept of an absence also exists. And so in situations where in your upbringing it has been important to say, trust this person if there's the concept that there are dangers, I think danger is tied to it too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's going to vary from child to child.
Yeah, right.
And we're way over time now. So please, everyone, go to the blog and tell us why you're scared shitless of clowns.
Or why you knock on wood.
And yes, or yell at wood, which I think is going to be the title of this episode. And the blog is at themagicaltalkinghat.com. So go there, tell us what you think. It's fun. You get to see what Mark thinks, and usually what Kia B thinks.
And Blood Sparrow.
You get to see what Blood Sparrow thinks moment to moment. And sometimes...
Is not arguably hard hat number two.
No.
Not arguably.
Not arguably.
And
frequently, the producer goes there, and she doesn't listen to the podcast, but when she finds out the stupid shit I said, she frequently goes on there to correct me. So check that out. It can be fascinating.
Yeah.
And I've heard that Ryan Gosling likes to lurk there, so pay attention. Anyway, go do that. Go write the hat. Do all those things. And like us on Facebook. Like the Magical Talking Hat on Facebook, and follow me on Twitter at Not Quite Tony. I'm up to 69 followers.
Wow.
And so I need at least one more so I can stop giggling and smirking every time I log into Twitter. All right, so that's it.
Okay.
We will see you next week.
Next week.
This margarita tastes good now.
Please disregard the previous hour of useless audio. This has been a production of the Magical Talking Hat Podcast. If you would like to contact us, and I don't know why you would, please do so at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. All music is provided courtesy of Jay Underberg. More of his PodSafe audio can be found at podsafeaudio.com/J_Underberg. Thank you.